You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Wednesday, March 14th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Professor Richard Wolff, Professor of Economics at the New School in New York, on Greek austerity, European austerity, and the coming American austerity, we shall see. Also on the program today, a goodbye cruel world letter from a former Goldman Sachs, as of I think now, executive. And just how sort of, I think corrupt the culture at Goldman Sachs has become. Some would probably argue that the baseline was pretty corrupt in and of itself, but be that as it may, also on the program today, the continuing onslaught against women and women's rights in this country by the Republican Party and the American Taliban. You know, the fish rots from the head down. And certainly when you have the leaders of the Republican Party, be it Mitt Romney or Rick Santorum or Rush Limbaugh, attacking women, it percolates through the right-wing ecosphere, I don't know, the right-wing body politic, and we're seeing it in so many different levels. We will talk more about that. And speaking of ecosphere, the seas are rising as a function of global warming. That's going to be a problem for those of you who live near the coastlines. And it also brings out the issue of the fact that taxpayers subsidize houses of millionaires on the coasts, which is always nice. You always hear, you know, that's the one thing you hear all the time about those libertarians complaining about picking winners and losers, about those rich people's homes on the coasts. Oh, wait. No, we don't. Yes, I'm back on my libertarian kick because we had one call in the better half of the program yesterday. And again, you know, it has to be possible on some level to have a conversation with these people that makes some measure of sense. It's either they have no idea what they're talking about, or literally you just need to be in your dorm room with a huge 6-foot bong to really be able to get into the conversation, because otherwise I can't seem to make head nor tails out of it. Also, corporate America, once again, it's not enough that they want to cut your Social Security, the right wing, and frankly, the establishment in this country, the moneyed elite in this country want to cut your Social Security. But that other leg of the stool, your pension, they want to get out from under those obligations as well. We have much more to discuss today, but right now we need to take a break, and we'll be right back with Professor Richard Wolff on that coming austerity. are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. And just a programming note, this program will move to 12 noon Eastern Time starting on Monday. 12 noon starting on Monday. So if you've been listening live starting at 11:30, you're going to have to wait a half hour. And, of course, the entire program will shift by a half hour. And meanwhile, I'd like to welcome to the program Richard Wolff. He is a professor of economics at the New School, has a weekly show on WBAI in New York, and author of several books. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
So I want to talk about, I've seen some of your work. You're talking about what's going on in Greece and how, at least in terms of the reaction by the establishment, by the economic elite, we can maybe anticipate some of that here. In fact, we're already seeing some of it in terms of austerity. But first, give us a sense of this deal that supposedly has been made or has stuck in terms of Greece and what the implications are for the Greek people.
Well, I think that the basic deal that has happened in Greece, if you put aside all the minor details, is really no different from the kind of deal that has often been reached between a company that borrowed too much money from a bank or a homeowner that borrowed too much from a lender for his or her mortgage. That is, you reach a point where you explain to the lender, I can't possibly pay back what I owe you, so I'm going to either have to declare bankruptcy and you get nothing, or you work something out with me to reduce the totality of my debt so I can manage to make the payments to a lower amount, and we'll each kind of suffer the consequences of all of this. What the Greeks did was basically go to their lenders and say, give us a break, reduce the amount we owe you. Well, the answer of the lender in the case of Greece, the banks and the European Community and the International Monetary Fund, was rather like the answer you get from banks here. And after a lot of negotiation, their debt was reduced by a little, but in exchange, they had to give up all kinds of things. They had to make commitments as a country to honor the new set of bonds that replaced the old set at a lower total amount, but they had to make commitments to basically forego all kinds of things that modern societies used to think they were entitled to. I'll give you just three examples. One, the Greek government agreed to lower the minimum wage of Greek people 20%. That is imposing on the poorest people in Greece, and Greece is a poor country, a cut of extraordinary size in order to free up money that used to be paid to them as minimum wage and use it to pay off lenders. Number two, the Greek government agreed to lay off 150,000 of the 800,000 people they currently employ in order, again, to free up government money to pay off the lenders and to have that as a fixed commitment going forward. And the third item that I would point out is this deal that was reached still leaves Greece with more of a debt than it, in fact, can reasonably expect to pay. It's a little bit like a person who gets a deal from their mortgage to reduce the debt on their house by $100,000, but they're still in no position, because they're unemployed, to pay the lower amount of mortgage each month. And so in a few months, they're going to see reapplication for bankruptcy, which, by the way, happens in this country all the time. And so if you lay off 150,000 workers, which the Greek government has pledged to do, in a country whose current unemployment rate is already 19%, you're going to see more people out of work, less money spent, therefore less revenue taken in by the Greek government, and then the whole situation is going to play itself out again. So I think the truth of it is, this is a game in which you shift the burden of this crisis onto the mass of people, and you buy yourself some time to try to come up with a solution. But since that's what all of these arrangements have been doing for the last 4 or 5 years, and we're still nowhere near out of the woods, I am not hopeful about the future in Greece and neither are the people of Greece, and neither are the major banks that will hold the new debt of Greece and are wondering whether they will ever get paid either.
Now let's talk about how Greece found itself in this situation, because the money that was lent to Greece essentially ended up going back and buying the products of other European countries.
Exactly.
This was money that was loaned by other countries, other institutions, to fund essentially their own economies, to turn the Greeks into bigger consumers, both from a national perspective and from an individual perspective. So, I mean, just outline that for us.
Well, it's a very interesting situation, and it has an exact parallel here in the United States. So actually, let me begin with the parallel here and show you how the Greeks are the same story. Starting in the 1970s here in the United States, real wages, that is the actual amount of money an average American worker got, adjusted for the prices he or she had to pay, stopped rising. And literally, we get today the same average real wage per hour in the United States as we had back in 1978. Nothing has gone up. But Americans still wanted to enjoy the American dream. Advertisers were telling us, as they always do, how much better off we'll be if we have this vacation, that car, this diet, and so on. And so Americans responded by not wanting to tell their children they couldn't go to a university and so forth, by borrowing wild amounts of money. And for the last 30 years, this country has lived on growing debt until that couldn't be continued anymore, because you can't keep accumulating debt on a stagnant wage base. And then our economy collapsed in 2007 as a result of all of this. Well, the Greek story is more or less the same. With the unification of Europe that happened at the end of the 1990s, the Greeks found themselves in an economically disadvantageous position. They were part now of a unified Europe that had much, much stronger economies in France and Germany than existed in places like Greece or Spain or Portugal or Italy. And the Germans and the French were determined to keep industry there, not to have their industries move to Greece and so on. And so the Greeks found themselves with no way to succeed economically in competition with their more powerful other parts of a unified Europe. And the European parts that were doing well, mainly Germany and France, said, okay, here's what we'll do. We will lend you the money so that you can keep buying our products, rather like the American upper classes lent money to the mass of American workers to buy the products that kept those in charge of the American economy earning their profits. And the Greeks kept doing it until they couldn't do it anymore, until they had built up a level of debt based on an economy which was puttering along but was not able to sustain that debt. You might think of Greece as the subprime borrower in Europe, a little bit like there were subprime mortgages here in the United States. And after a certain point, the system collapses because you cannot keep hyping people's purchasing power with debt when you don't give them the chance economically to earn the wages, or in the case of Greece, to produce the outputs that can keep them a viable economic system. And that has to be confronted. If you want a unified Europe, then you have to equalize the conditions across the continent. The French and Germans and the Scandinavians were unwilling to do that. They wanted a unified Europe in which they're even stronger than they were before. But the only way that's going to work is if the weaker parts of it become even weaker than before. And in the end, that's not a viable way to have a unified Europe, any more than the kind of things we're doing between the 99 and 1% here is a viable way for the future of the United States.
Can you help me with making a distinction between the privately held debt and the publicly held debt? In other words, you know, the scenario you talk about in this country where we have stagnant wages for over 30 years while simultaneously having increased productivity. So those profits
right.
are going somewhere. They're ending up in shareholders' hands. They're ending up in the CEO's hands or the board of
right.
directors' hands. But when we talk about Greece, we're talking about, and you know, we can also, we have a similar analogy in this country to a certain extent, but we're talking about publicly held debt. In other words, the government holding the debt, as opposed to sort of the credit card bills of all the individuals in the country. Make that distinction for me, because I'm not quite clear where those lines are drawn, particularly in the context of Greece.
Okay, fine. If you look at the different conditions of the different countries in Europe, you very quickly see something. And that is, in some cases, like Greece, for example, the debt is the debt of the government. Individual Greeks do not borrow money in anything like the way, for example, Americans do. That's why you don't see across Greece a foreclosure movement like you had here in the United States, because the country in Greece borrowed the money, and then you might think of it this way. They turned around and paid their workers decent rising wages. And the only way that Greek workers were able to get decent rising wages was because they had a generous government, which was able to be generous because it did the borrowing. In a place like Spain, it isn't so much the government's debt that's the problem. It is the problem of individual Spanish families borrowing money to sustain a lifestyle that they could not afford based on the wages they actually earned and the economic system they live on. In the end, it doesn't matter all that much, except politically, because the lenders are the same. It's either the wealthy big corporations and the banks they put their money in France and Germany, lending to the Italian government or to the Spanish family or to the regional government in Portugal or whatever. The basic problem is always the same. Economic uneven development that is handled in a capitalist system, not by saying, well, we have to equalize the different regions so they can hold their own in a kind of mutual economic exchange. We don't work it that way. We ought to, but we don't. Instead, we allow those who are relatively better off to use their advantages to stay that way, and in any case, often to make the disadvantages of the poorer parts of the country or the poorer parts of the population, or in Europe's case, the poorer parts of the continent, become more and more dependent and more unequal. And then we paper over the situation of inequality by a lending program that goes from the successful to the unsuccessful, from the rich to the poor, from those making more money to those who they're taking the money from. We imagine for a decade or two that this is all a wonderful arrangement. Let me underscore, you know, the job of a banker, the way we teach it in economics programs, is to be a quote-unquote prudent lender.
Right.
We're all supposed to trust the bank to put our money in the deposits, and then they're supposed to be the experts who only lend out to a prudent borrower. When the loan goes bad, it doesn't just mean that the borrower didn't behave properly. It means also that the lender didn't do his job. All those banks in Europe, all with their government regulators, were lending like there's no tomorrow to the Greek and Spanish and Portuguese, both the public borrowers there and the private borrowers there, in ways that are now obviously imprudent. And we do not punish the lenders anything like we punish the borrowers when these loans go bad, and that's not a good way to manage it, putting it even aside.
Right. Well, theoretically, that's why the lenders get interest, isn't it? I mean, isn't it because aren't we always taught that the reason why you get a return on the money you lend is because baked into that interest is the risk that some of your borrowers won't return that money? And so you're taking some type of risk, and the flip side of that is, of course, sometimes you've got to eat it, and they're not eating it is essentially the problem.
That's right, because they never expected, never factored in, and never really believed what it is they tell us as the teachers we're supposed to teach everybody. You learned your lesson well. You understand that the appropriate reward for the risk you take as a lender is that you charge interest. And that is supposed to compensate you for those eventualities in which you don't get paid back. But obviously, the system only works so long as there isn't what we used to call a run on the lender. That is, there aren't so many people unable to pay back that your interest doesn't begin to cover what it is. And that is always a result of the underlying economic situation, and they don't want to have to pay for that, so they are demanding the kinds of deals, the French and German banks in the case of Greece, all banks in the United States in the case of our larger population, they don't want to pay the cost of this collapsed economic system, so they want government bailouts, they want rewritten loan covenants, they want to hold on to as much in a declining situation as they can, and what they don't face, neither in Europe nor here, is that if you succeed at pushing the costs of this crisis onto the mass of people in lower wages, in high unemployment, in government cutbacks, you are not solving the problem. You are perpetuating the very inequalities that got you into it.
Right. I mean, the idea is that these austerity measures are actually going to shrink the economy and therefore shrink the revenues, and you're still at that. It's a self-fulfilling loop in some respects. And in fact,
right.
for when we talk about Spain and we talk about the United States, to the extent that we have an increasing deficit in debt, that is as much of a function of the recession and the incapacity for and the lack of revenue that's coming into the government as it is anything else. I mean, not just on the spending side, it's as much on the revenue side as anything else.
Absolutely, and because the fear of those who are in business and those who are rich, that if you open up the real question of the revenue side, whether it's in a place like Greece or in the United States, they are very afraid that the obvious finger will point to them. If you're going to deal with the government's debt problems by finding, quote-unquote, new sources of revenue, then in a time of unemployment, of cutting minimum wages, of all the rest, you're not going to point the finger at the mass of people, partly because they don't have the money, and partly because if you tried, you'd have a revolution on your hands. So you end up saying, well, let's go get it from the rich and the corporations. They've actually enjoyed tax cuts of huge proportions over the last 30 or 40 years. They are richer relative to the rest of the population today than they have been for 30 or 40 years. So if we start talking revenue, the finger is going to point at them, which is why you get this peculiar imbalance in all these discussions of government or private debt, namely a discussion only about austerity programs, cut back spending. Nobody wants to remember that a budget has two sides, the expenditure side, but also the revenue side. And to reduce a deficit or to reduce a government debt, you can do that by looking at the revenue side. And here in the United States, it's even more dramatic. You know, the top income tax rate in the United States in the 50s and 60s was 91%. Today, the top rate is 35%. It doesn't take rocket science to understand that if the government's stimulus of a broken economy wanted to happen without raising our government debt, the way to go is to go back to the levels, or at least toward the levels of income tax on wealthy people that we used to have, that we had in the 50s and 60s when, by the way, unemployment was lower than it is today and economic growth faster than it is today. And that way we would give the government the money with which to get us out of this crisis without increasing anybody's deficit or debt. And the reason we never discuss that, why our political campaigns are campaigns between those who want to cut expenditure a lot and those who want to cut it less, is because we've been able, or they've been able, to render the revenue side of the budget a kind of taboo topic.
Right. And commensurate with that sort of income disparity becomes a serious disparity in the political power of the various groups.
Right. And you can hardly blame them, right? If you give more and more of your wealth to a smaller and smaller slice of your population, those people who are in the privileged sector would be strange indeed in the history of the human race if they didn't recognize the vulnerability of this very good fortune they're having and take steps to protect themselves by making sure that the one-person, one-vote democratic system they have around them is not used to enable politics to undo what they've gotten in the economy. So controlling politics is obviously the way they have to go, and they've understood that in every one of these countries.
In terms of gaining some type of economic stability, what are the options, or what could have been the options available to Greece, and contrast that with the options that are available to the United States? Because while I believe that we are going to see, and we have to a certain extent, I mean, if you look at how many government jobs have been lost over the past couple of years, and the talk of cutting Social Security or cutting Medicare by either raising the age or changing the CPI, whatever it is, we're talking about austerity in this country as well.
Absolutely.
But we have more options than Greece because of the nature of our economy and our control of our currency.
Yes, that is no question the case. We remain the biggest and strongest economy in the world. We have incredible natural resources. We have a highly trained and skilled labor force. I could not agree more that the conditions needed to be able to solve this problem are all here. What we lack is an economic system that can put them together. I mean, the simplest way of articulating that, and this is true for Greece also, is that if you have 10 or 20% of your people unemployed who want and need jobs, if the proportion of your industrial capacity, your tools, your equipment, machines, and so on, that are sitting idle is in the nature of 30%, which it is both in this country and in Greece, then you're talking about a failed economic system that cannot put together the people who need and want to work with the tools, equipment, and raw materials they need to work with and on to produce the wealth that we desperately need to deal with our poverty, with our need for childcare, with our need for proper education systems, and so on. And the answer to that, I think, for the Greeks, as for the United States, and I'm a little bit a proud American here, is to say we have that answer, at least in the short run, from our own history. I mean, if you go back to the 1930s, when we had, let's say, 1933-34, unemployment rate 25%, three times what it is today. Roosevelt, who comes in as a kind of centrist Democrat, changes his politics radically through pressure from below, and what does he do? Does he impose an austerity the way we discuss it in terms of Greece or the United States? Absolutely not. He does the opposite. He creates the Social Security system. In the middle of a Great Depression, not only does he not cut back Social Security, as you rightly pointed out, we're discussing and doing now, he creates Social Security. He says to the Americans over 65 who've done a lifetime of work, I'm now going to give you a pension as the government for the rest of your life. He creates the unemployment compensation system. We never had that before either, in which he says to the then tens of millions of Americans unemployed, I'm going to give you a year or two of weekly paychecks because you're unemployed. And then finally, he creates a federal jobs program. He puts to work 12.5 million Americans between 1934 and 1941, working and getting an income from the federal government. All of that took an enormous amount of money. It wasn't cutting back programs for the mass of people. It was giving them jobs and income. It was what you might call trickle-up economics, in which the economy as a whole was to be stimulated by helping those at the bottom who were suffering the most. In my own humble opinion, that would be even better policy today in the United States and Greece than it was then, and it would certainly work better than the trickle-down economics of bailing out the folks at the top have been able to work over the last 5 years.
In the context of this country, what do you think would be the best mechanism to do that? And this would be money that the government should actually be borrowing more money. We have historically low interest rates. Is that what you would suggest in the context of this country?
No, I would, again, be a bit more faithful. Not that I want to overdo it. Franklin Roosevelt had his problems, too. But I would rather take the page from him. He did not simply raise the money to create Social Security, unemployment compensation, and a federal jobs program by borrowing. What has to be understood is he went to the business community of the United States and to the rich After all, being a Roosevelt, that was his milieu anyway. And he said to them, look, you got to help me. You've got to give me the money with which to take care of the mass of people going through the worst depression in the history of capitalism. Because if you don't, the CIO, the socialists, the communists, and remember those organizations were very strong then, they're going to come down the road and they're going to offer you a much poorer deal than I'm offering you. You give me the money. I will go to the unions and the socialists and the communists. I will provide a mass social welfare program that they will have to agree with me about. And in exchange, I'll agree to get them to agree not to interfere with your business. You will remain the shareholders, the boards of directors, and all the rest. And basically, he split the business community. Half of them were not persuaded by what he said and became the sworn enemies of what we later call the New Deal. But the other half of the business community and the rich agreed with him, rather like a Warren Buffett today agrees with raising taxes on the rich and so on. They said yes, they were persuaded by his argument. And between the support from the mass of the Democratic Party below and half of the wealthy folks at the top, you got the kind of support for Roosevelt that enabled the New Deal to be pushed through, that enabled the mass of people never to suffer the way they have would have had otherwise, and you made Mr. Roosevelt the first president in American history to be reelected four times because he became a virtual saint for half the population in the country. It seems to me we ought to learn that the way to stimulate the economy is to do the kinds of things he did, you know, adjusted for our conditions today, but not to pay for it by ever more borrowing. Deficits and debts are real problems. The way to deal with it is to at least move part of the way back to what Roosevelt did, which was to raise taxes on the wealthy and to raise taxes on corporations. I mean, just to give you a footnote of history. In 1942 and 3, Roosevelt sent to the Congress of the United States a proposal for a 100% top income tax bracket. What that means is above a certain amount, you earn anything, you give all of it to the government. It's in effect a maximum salary or wage or income, as well as a minimum for poor people. You have a maximum for the rich. The Congress went ballistic about that, of course, led by the Republican Party, again, of course. But in the end, a compromise was dealt with, and in the middle of the 1940s, they accepted a 94% top income tax bracket rate, so that rich people above a certain amount had to give the government 94 cents of every dollar they earned and could only keep six. And even in the 1950s and 60s, the top rate was 91%, a rate endorsed by Republican as well as Democratic presidents, by Republican as well as Democratic Congresses. And the argument in those days was, we've just been through a Great Depression, followed by a world war. We have to rebuild our economy and society. And the corporations and the rich who have the most to help do that are the ones who ought to be paying the most. And everybody thought that was reasonable and patriotic, and as it should be. And if we're going through the fifth year of a crisis now, as I believe we all understand we are, it seems to me the same logic ought to move us in the same direction, and that we have a lesson from our own history that I find it strange, as I look around me, that there's such an amnesia about it.
Well, as a political calculation, I mean, are we anywhere close to that? In other words, is it going to take, you know, the difference between then and now, of course, is that we do have Social Security now. And that we do have Medicare, and we do have we still are living under the New Deal, and it's almost letting the air out of the political tire in terms of providing that pressure from the bottom up, and it's also it's not putting enough pressure to divide the business community, as it were, with the sense that they could be looking at a worse deal down the road.
Well, I think you're right, but I would inflect it slightly differently. I think that the majority of those at the top, whether they're corporates or executives or folks with a lot of money, still believe, and I understand how that might be, that they're going to get out of this crisis without having to give up much of anything They've spent the last 30 or 40 years basically rolling back the New Deal. Whether you look at the tax rates I quoted to you that have come way back down again, or you look at the repeal of things like the Glass-Steagall Act in terms of financial regulation, they've really done pretty well. And they're still hoping that they can slither out of the current morass without having to have the kind of comeuppance that Roosevelt basically imposed on them. And, you know, I can't predict the future any better than anyone else. Maybe they're right. Maybe if I were like them, I too would try to hold on. But I think in the remarks you get from folks like Warren Buffett and others, there is a growing worry among the folks at the top too that they could be making a classic tragic miscalculation in which they keep holding on, they keep not wanting to have to pay the costs of a crisis that they, more than anyone else, is responsible for, even though it's a systemic problem, that they may be making a terrible miscalculation and risking the entirety of the system they have come to depend on, and there are more and more voices among them that are saying that to them. They don't have the force of the President of the United States, obviously, although I did notice that Mr. Obama and Mr. Buffett found ways to help each other and continue to do so, that those are hints in a certain direction. But you're right. We don't have the mass base of pressure from below that was formed and organized in the CIO and the Socialist and Communist parties. We still have only the beginnings of the Tea Party-type stuff on the right and the Occupy movement on the left, and those are much less focused and developed. But I think the direction in which things are going is more and more in that. I don't think that the Europeans are the only place that is having more general strikes in the last 12 months than they did in the previous 35 years. I think the turmoil of the austerity programs there is a preview of what is coming here as the rising austerity here, which takes a different form from Europe because of our conventions here. But if you look at Harrisburg, PA, declaring bankruptcy, and Stockton, California, and the entire Jefferson County in Alabama, or Central Falls in Rhode Island, all of those situations are a rising crescendo of closing down the economic well-being of the mass of people, and that can't go on forever, especially in a country that prides itself on the imaginary notion that we're all in the middle class and that we live in a country that is somehow pre-God-given the right to have a better life for each generation. That's all gone now. And as the realization of that settles in, I think you're going to see a lot of political turmoil here that Americans are not prepared for.
Professor Richard Wolff from the New School. You can check out his site at rdwolff.com. We'll put a link up at majority.fm. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation. It was good to talk with you.
Good to talk to you. All right, folks. Now we will head into the better half of the program. I want to remind you, on Monday, this coming Monday, what's the date? Monday, March 19th. We are going to be moving this program to 12 noon. It will start at 12 noon. For those of you who listen live, that means our podcast will be up 30 minutes later than it is on any given day. So we generally have it up by 2. Now it'll be up by 2:30. Change your clocks. Rearrange your schedules. Folks, when you move a juggernaut of this size in one direction or another, through the temporal continuum, it takes an enormous amount of resources. Resources that only you can provide by supporting this program and becoming a member today at majority.fm. What do I have to do, people, besides give you, I mean, just the 40 minutes a day for free should be, well, obviously it wouldn't be free at that point, but that should be enough to become a member. Not to mention, I think we've had some of our better halves ever this past week. Great conversations, great call-ins, libertarians, softcore models, people who have problems with pornography, people who enjoy pornography, people who, well, mostly have problems with libertarians, although the libertarians keep calling. You can join this program at majority.fm. Support the program. You can also support it by buying your Amazon junk through our Amazon link at majority.fm. Support the show. And then just clicking on that, bookmarking it, buying all your junk through there. JustCoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, and chocolate. 10% discount with the coupon code MAJORITY. Give us a review on iTunes. Buy our merch. Call into the program next, 646-257-3920. We'll take your IMs at Majority FM, and we got these Goldman stories, a bunch of them. You'll enjoy it.